Okay, thank you. So I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this chance to speak over here, this very distinguished audience. I'd also like to thank Steve Kaleb for agreeing to switch his time slot with me, and also finally like to thank Stephanie and Amanda, because they're not here, but they've been enormously helpful in the last couple of days and of course before that. Okay, so here's the title of my talk, Towards a Consistent Quantum Dynamics for Euclidean Loop Quantum Gravity, a Weak Coupling Limit. The word consistent in the title is used in the context of Hamiltonian formulations of generally covariant theories, wherein evolution proceeds along foliations of the background or the emergent spacetime, and evolution along different foliations are consistent in the sense that they all yield the same spacetime. This consistency is coded in the characteristic structure of the classical Poisson bracket algebra of constraints, and this was shown in this beautiful paper by Hojman, Teitelboom, and Kukash a long time ago. So therefore, one expects that in the quantum theory, a notion of spacetime covariance will arise only if the classical algebra of constraints is represented in an anomaly-free manner. So in this talk, what I will do is focus on the most non-trivial part of the constraint algebra, which is that between a pair of Hamiltonian constraints, and that's where one has structure functions and various complications. So let me now turn to a brief review of the status of the Hamiltonian constraint in loop quantum gravity. Of course, in this talk, I will be working within the loop quantum gravity framework exclusively. So in the mid-90s, Thomas constructed a Hamiltonian constraint for loop quantum gravity in his seminal quantum spin dynamics papers. This was really pioneering work, and it's very hard to do this in loop quantum gravity. And the reason it's hard is because the Hamiltonian constraint is made out of local fields, like the curvature of the connection, whereas the basic objects in loop quantum gravity are the non-local holonomies. And therefore, in classical theory, this is not a problem, because one can obtain the curvature as a limit of a one-parameter family of holonomies around a one-parameter family of loops which shrink to a point. So you can massage that and in the limit get out the curvature at the point. But in the quantum theory, this limit in terms of operators simply doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist for a good reason. The theory has a background independent representation. So you really can't tell, you know, the difference between a big loop, a small loop, and a smaller loop. And so this limit doesn't exist. Now, given that that is true, how can one proceed? Because one has to reproduce the Hamiltonian constraint. One fixes a triangulation of the spatial manifold. Then one constructs finite triangulation approximants to all the local fields which appear in the Hamiltonian constraint. And these approximants are constructed in terms of the basic holonomy and flux variables. So one obtains then a Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation. Then one replaces the holonomy and flux approximants to these various pieces by the corresponding operators and obtains an operator at finite triangulation. And then finally, one seeks to take the triangulation to be infinitely fine and construct the continuum limit action of this operator. So the idea is that while, you know, individual bits and pieces don't admit continuum limit actions, this whole conglomeration of stuff, which is the Hamiltonian constraint, could perhaps have a nice continuum limit. And what Thomas showed is that this continuum limit action exists on diffeomorphism invariant states. He also computed the continuum limit action of the commutator over there and showed that it vanished. So this is what one would expect, because the Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonian constraints is proportional to the diffeomorphism constraint. So this is all internally consistent. And of course, the question is everything all right, or is this the end of the story? So my own view is that the calculation is not an effective probe for the existence or the lack of existence of an anomaly. And so to say more about that, Let me illustrate this by considering the simplest implementation of Thomas's Hamiltonian constraint. And let me call the commutator between a pair of Hamiltonian constraints to be the left-hand side, and the operator correspondent between the Poisson brackets to be the right-hand side. So while the left-hand side and right-hand side vanish, they vanish for very different reasons. The left-hand side vanishes because the second constraint doesn't really act on the deformations generated by the first, whereas the right-hand side vanishes for a very robust and different reason, which I call the too many factors of delta. So what do I mean by this? Well, when you're doing a finite triangulation approximant to the right-hand side, then one replaces the coordinate measure by delta cubed. One replaces the electric field operators by fluxes by delta squared, square root of q by volume by delta cubed, curvature by holonomy approximants by delta squared, and then just puts everything together. And what one finds is an overall factor of delta times some finite operator. And so irrespective of the finest structure of this finite operator, the right-hand side goes to zero. It turns out that the right-hand side was nicely written by Thomas in terms of a small diffeomorphism minus the identity. So it kind of doubly vanishes on the space of diffeo invariant states. So what happens if the states are not diffeomorphism invariant? Well, one would still expect the right-hand side to vanish because of this factor over here. And what Lewandowski and Marol showed in their Habitat paper by considering states which were not diffeomorphism invariant is that the left-hand side also vanished. So to this level, everything is consistent. But then one can ask, well, what happens if not only are the states diffeomorphism invariant, but somehow or the other, we have more factors of delta inverse? Then, you know, this factor would go away, and one would get a non-trivial right-hand side. And this is what Lewandowski and Marolf and Gambini and Pullin actually did, just by ad hoc putting in factors of delta inverse. And they found a non-trivial right-hand side and very strong hints of an anomaly if one did the same thing to the left-hand side. So a more elegant way of jacking up the factors of delta inverse is to go to higher density weight constraints. So how does that work? Well, square root of q can be, as I in the last slide, is just volume by delta cube. So if you multiply the constraint by powers of square root of q, you end up with more powers of delta inverse. And so you can create a situation where you get a non-trivial right-hand side. And the question is, when you do this, is the left-hand side also non-zero for these higher density weight constraints? And if it is non-zero, is the left-hand side equal to the right-hand side? So the moral of this little sort of story is that the right-hand side for the density weight 1 constraints which Thomas uses just vanishes. You know, I mean, the finer structure doesn't matter. It vanishes for a very robust reason. And there are a variety of ways in which the left-hand side can be made to vanish for the density weight 1 case. And to really probe whether we have an anomaly or not, we have to bring out the right-hand side from triviality and then just check what happens. And so we need to use higher than unit density weight constraints, which is like kind of a bizarre idea because people have been always using the density weight 1 constraints for good reasons. And the good reason is that, as Thomas showed and as is true from general considerations, the density weight 1 Hamiltonian constraint at finite triangulation yields a finite operator with no factors of delta at all. And so if I scale it by factors of square root of q, I'm going to get factors of delta in the denominator, and this is going to be singular in the limit delta goes to zero. So does that kill everything, or is there some way to proceed? And the best thing to do is to have a sanity check and go to toy models and see what happens there. So over the past few years with Alok Laddha, I've been looking at a couple of toy models in an LQG-like quantization where one can push the whole thing through to the end. And the two models are parameterized field theory, which is just the theory of a free scalar field on flat spacetime in diffeomorphism invariant disguise, and the Hussain-Kukash model, Vikar is here, which is just gravity without the Hamiltonian constraint. And in these models, this is what we learn. We learn that if one wants a non-trivial anomaly-free constraint algebra, then one has to consider singular constraint operators for exactly the reasons I sketched out in the last slide. And then how does it work? Because these operators are kinematically singular. Well, it turns out that in these models, the action of the constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint, is coded in terms of spatial diffeomorphisms. And so the constraint can be written roughly as 1 over delta, which is the singular part, times a small diffeomorphism minus the identity. And this delta going to 0 limit is not defined on the kinematical Hilbert space, but it is well defined on a suitable space of off-shell states. And what are these off-shell states? These off-shell states are labeled by function. This is just a function from n copies of the manifold to the complexes, and it's smooth. And what the constraint at finite triangulation, so let me say this a little bit more. So there's a label which is a function, and this state is not kinematical. So it's a non-normalizable sum of spin network states. And the weights in this sum are given by various evaluations of this function in some particular way. And what the constraint does is that it takes a state labeled by the function f and gives you something which is labeled by the function g, where g is just the difference of f at, you know, evaluated at its original point and its arguments which are moved by this small diffeomorphism and divided by this delta, which is very important. Because as delta goes to 0, this thing becomes a Lie derivative. If delta was not 0, it would just be trivial. So this delta is important, singular constraints are important, and you get a Lie derivative, and you get a representation of the constraint algebra in terms of Lie derivatives. And it all works out fine, because in both these models, the constraint algebra is a Lie algebra, and you have an anomaly-free representation. However, gravity has structure functions, and of course a host of other complications, and so in order to make more progress, one would like to now go to a slightly more complicated scenario, which is not as complicated as gravity, but is still has enough structure that one can probe things with in the context of structure functions. And what Alok Ladha did is he replaced the SU2 triad rotation group of Euclidean gravity by the abelian group U1 cubed. And turns out that the constraint algebra of this model is completely isomorphic to that of gravity. And as later Miguel Campilla pointed out to us, this is exactly the same as Lie's novel G Newtonian going to zero limit of Euclidean gravity. And hence, you know, the words in my title. So in this talk, what I'm going to do is I'm going to examine the constraint algebra within an LQG type of quantization of this U1 cube model. There has been work done by Henderson, Ladha, and Casey Tomlin in a 2+1 dimensional context. And some of that you'll hear more about in Casey's talk today. Here I'm going to concentrate mainly on the 3+1 case. And this is work I've done with Casey, so some of that also will be in more detail perhaps in his talk. And if there is time, I'll briefly mention how all these constructions which we did could be made diffeomorphism covariant. So let me now move. And before telling you what the model is, let me just outline once again what the strategy is going to be. So the strategy is going to be as follows. I'm going to use high density constraints, higher than unit, so that I get the constraint as a finite operator minus the identity by delta, just like in the toy models. I'm going to then try and code the action of this constraint in terms of spatial diffeomorphisms. Then I will try to define the delta going to zero limit of this on a suitable set of off-shell states. And whenever I'm presented with choices, I'm going to use structures which are generalizable to SU2, so that one has a hope of doing Euclidean gravity, and then who knows, perhaps Lorentzian. Now, the key takeaway point at this stage, and probably from my talk, really is the following. Why does all this work, and why does this have a chance of working in Euclidean gravity? The reason is that the constraint now is going to act roughly in terms of diffeomorphisms. So diffeomorphisms move vertices of spin nets on which they act on. In the left-hand side, the second constraint acts on the moved vertices generated by the action of the first one. And this movement gives rise to a difference of these evaluations of the functions, and it's precisely this delta inverse factor which comes in the constraint which converts this into a non-trivial derivative. Okay, so that's where the higher density weight is important. And in the right-hand side, all these delta inverse factors which you put in due to higher density, cancel these too many delta factors in the numerator, and you get both left-hand side and right-hand side being non-trivial. So let me now go to the U1 cube theory. What is the phase space of this theory? It's just a triplet of U1 electric fields and conjugate U1 connections. The constraints are a triplet of abelian Gauss laws, three diffeomorphism constraints, and then a Hamiltonian constraint, just EEF equal to 0. And the curvature is just the abelian curvature. So what is the quantum state space? Well, it's spanned by the U1 cubed analogs of these SU2 spin networks. So each such state is labeled by a closed oriented graph. And in turn, each edge of this graph is labeled by a triplet of integer valued charges, which are just representations of U1 cubed. So I call these charge network states because they have charges on them. And this function can, the U1 cubed charge network can also be realized just like as in what happens in the SU2 case. It can be realized as a function, a wave function of the connection. And the wave function of the connection is just the product of edge holonomies of the connection in the appropriate representations, just the product of all this. Okay, so with this, let's now go to the constraints. So the first step is to choose a high enough density weight so that you get this 1 over delta. And I won't go into the details of that. It's not too hard. It turns out that what one needs is a weight 4 by 3 constraint and therefore a lapse of weight minus 1/3. So the constraint then is just E, and F. But I've grouped together some terms in red which are going to be extremely important for what I have to say in the rest of the talk. What about the action through diffeomorphisms? That's the next step. I have to code the action of the constraint in terms of diffeos. So to do this, use this nice identity, which one uses all the time in this game, which says that a shift or a vector field dotted with the curvature gives you a Lie derivative of the connection minus a gradient term. Details are not important, but a Lie derivative comes in here. This conglomeration of terms together, if you just put in, you know, the density weight of all these objects, you find that this guy transforms as a vector field. Not a vector field of any density, but just a vector field. And so I'm going to call it an electric shift because it depends on the electric field. So you take this and you use this identity for the electric shift, and then you can write down the Hamiltonian constraint as a Lie derivative term times E plus a Gauss law term. This term just gives you a Gauss law term. So if the wave function is gauge invariant, this term goes away, and you have E can be replaced by a functional derivative. So you have a functional derivative times a Lie derivative. So that at finite triangulation, this looks at 1 over delta times the wave function evaluated at some moved argument times the wave minus one, the wave function at the original argument. And the movement has this small diffeomorphism inside it. But it is not just a small diffeomorphism because there are all these internal indices and there's shuffling going on. There's some typos with these small, you know, these spatial indices, but I just want you to see the general structure, that's all. So it's not just a diffeo, but there are internal indices which are being shuffled. So if I set now this psi over here to be a spin net, to be a charge network state, then you can just do what this tells you to do, and you find that the action of the constraint deforms the state by a combination of diffeomorphisms and charge reshufflings corresponding to these internal index reshufflings. So what are these diffeomorphisms? These diffeomorphisms are generated by this electric shift field. But since it's phase space dependent, in the quantum theory, the electric shift becomes a quantum operator. So I call it the quantum shift. And this is what it looks like. And since it has this factor of inverse determinant of the metric, it's only going to be non-zero at vertices of the charge network, just like using Thiemann-like identities. So at a vertex, this is what it looks like. It's actually diagonalized by the charge network basis. And the eigenvalue is just, you know, the evaluation of the shift at the vertex. Then you have an eigenvalue for this inverse thing over here. And then the electric field just pulls out a factor of the charge times edge tangent vectors at that vertex. The things in red are coordinate dependent, because remember now that the lapse is a density weighted object and I need a coordinate system in order to evaluate it. So this is coordinate dependent, and the tangent vectors are normalized again in the coordinate system. So we need a regulating coordinate patch to actually evaluate this eigenvalue, and while you can take the coordinate patch away, there is a memory of the coordinate patch in terms of these objects, and I'll say more about it towards the end of my talk. But be as it may, let's work with this. What are the deformations generated by the quantum shift then. So let me fix the ith copy of U1 cubed, of U1, and consider an m-valent vertex. Well, then from here, the quantum shift eigenvalue is just a sum of m tangent vectors and the ith vectors along the ith edge. Therefore, what you get at finite triangulation then is a sum, roughly speaking, of m deformed charge nets, where the ith charge net is deformed along the ith edge. So what are these deformations in more detail? Just show you through a figure. So I'm homing in the neighborhood of a vertex of some charge network state, and I'm acting by a finite triangulation Hamiltonian constraint. So because the shift vanishes outside the vertex, at finite triangulation, the deformation is confined to a region delta, of size delta in this coordinate patch. And I'm showing you a case in which one of these, you'll get four deformed terms. I'm just showing you the one which is deformed along this edge. And I'm exaggerating these, you know, distances. So this is some delta to the q. You can't see q. Q is greater than 1, right? So this at small delta is much smaller than this thing over here. So what's happening is that along this edge, as delta goes to 0, the vertex structure is being just pulled, you know, along, so that as delta goes to 0, it's really just acting exactly along this edge. Okay? So that's the idea. And the new, you know, the corresponding, so this is the vertex structure here. This is the deformed vertex structure here by this electric diffeomorphism. And the charges here are just some flipped versions of these charges. And therefore, at these vertices, for charge conservation, these charges are also, you know, different from the original ones. So you have a deformation with charge flips. And the important thing for later is that this, what I'd call the parent graph, is actually embedded in its child. Okay? So you can see that you can reconstruct the parent graph from this child over here. OK, now the left-hand side is a commutator. So we come and act with a second Hamiltonian constraint, and it acts on this deformed vertex as promised. And it does exactly the same decoration over here. And then you go ahead and evaluate the commutator at finite triangulation. OK, what about the right-hand side? Now, the right-hand side is the operator version of the Poisson bracket. So it's proportional to a diffeomorphism constraint. And what one could do, and that's what Thomas did, is one could try and write the right-hand side as a small diffeomorphism minus the identity. And because of our high density, we also get a factor of delta. OK, we could do this. But wouldn't it be nice if we could also write the right-hand side as a commutator? Because then we would get two parameters, delta and delta prime, just as in the left-hand side. And it would be much easier to compare the two. So can we do this? Well, let me now consider a Hamiltonian constraint of arbitrary density weight parameterized by some real parameter alpha, so that when alpha is equal to half, this is 1 minus half equal to half times 2, which is 1, right? So alpha equal to half is density weight 1, but this is arbitrary density weight. And let me consider the exact same combination of quantities which form the electric shift. And again, if you accept that I put in a q to the minus alpha here, and if you put in all the density weights once again, this transforms as a vector field. I can take this vector field and smear the diffeomorphism constraint with it. And then we have this really nice identity, which tells you that the Poisson bracket between a pair of Hamiltonian constraints is really just the Poisson bracket between a pair of electric diffeomorphism constraints. And this is valid not only for U1 cubed, it's valid for SU2, it's valid for 2 plus 1 dimensions, it's valid for 3 plus 1 dimensions. And in all these cases, it trivializes if alpha equal to half, by which I mean that this Poisson bracket just vanishes. So it's not equal to anything except 0, and you can't use it. So you would not have been able to use it for the density weight 1 case, but we are not in the density weight 1 case. We have density weight 4 by 3, which works out to alpha equal to 1 by 3, and we can use it. So what does this look like then? What do the deformations look like? Well, here, we only have a diffeomorphism generated by the electric shift. You don't have these charge flips. So it's everything which was before, but it's much simpler. You don't have any charge flipping. And so it looks like this. So remember, this was just the Hamiltonian constraint. And you had the old edges present because of charge conservation and charge flipping over here. Over here, you don't have these old edges present. This is just, you know, the charge here just flows over here, and you just have a deformation of this vertex by this singular kind of diffeomorphism. Then you come and act with a second guy, and it goes and deforms it further. So these things look structurally very, very similar, and this is the reason why you can make progress in comparing them and trying to progress towards an anomaly-free situation where the left-hand side and right-hand sides agree. To do that, one has to define a suitable space of off-shell states, because as I explained, this is just going to be singular on the kinematic Hilbert space. We define these off-shell states in, you know, a similar manner as before. So these off-shell states are labeled by function f, and this function is a function from n copies, little n copies of the manifold to the complexes, and the off-shell state is a sum over a set of bras, s bar. So these are charge network bras, weighted by the evaluation of this function on the vertices of the bra, which it multiplies. And it turns out that all the bras in this set have vertices of relevance, which are going to be always little n in number. So what is this set of bras? Well, this has to be constructed. So let me just call it B for the moment. And let me tell you what the continuum limit is, and you know what is the quantity we want to compute. Well, it's just the following. You take the left-hand side operator, finite triangulation, evaluate its action on some charge network state S, and then kind of dot it with this psi f, which has all these bras in, so you get some complex number, which is a function of delta and delta prime, and then you take the limit first of delta prime going to 0 and then of delta going to 0. You do it for all of, you know, all these charge nets S and all these off-shell state psi f, and you get a whole set of complex numbers, you get a whole set of complex numbers for the exact same thing with the right-hand side, and this set has to equal, you know, these two sets have to be equal. This is when you say that you have an anomaly-free situation. So how does one, you know, what are the properties of B so that this actually is true? So supposing B actually contains a double Hamiltonian deformation of some state, then that is going to contribute to the left-hand side, right? Because it's going to have some non-trivial dot product with something over here. But then the right-hand side needs to be non-trivial, and so the right-hand side, if it is non-trivial, the same set B must also contain a double electric diffeomorphism of that state. Therefore, to check and to ensure that this is true, I must have the following. Given a double Hamiltonian deformed state, I need to infer from that the undeformed state, then act on it by two electric diffeomorphisms, take that state and ensure that it's also in the set B. And similarly, the other way around. And this brings us to ancestry, really. I don't know what else to call it. So how can one do this? Well, given a double Hamiltonian deformation of some parent state, I've already showed you earlier that the parent state is actually, you know, the graph is embedded in the children. So one can easily work out, it turns out, just looking at this deformed child or grandchild, you can just go back and work out who the parent is uniquely. And if there are n actions of the Hamiltonian constraint, you can trace the entire lineage back, you know, to the original parent. What about the double diffeomorphism child? Well, here there's no parental embedding, right? I mean, there's no parental embedding into the child, and it's much more difficult than to infer a parent, right? So, but nevertheless, what happens is that if you look at the child, it has enough genetic traces so that you can infer, just looking at it, what all the possible parents could be of this child. So you take all of them and you put them in this set B. And in order to, you know, go back and forth between these children and parents and so on, you start introducing causal notions, and these are probably a little bit at least reminiscent from these sequential growth things in causal sets, and you know, you actually can define from these deformed children their one past, the, you know, and take a future completion of the one past and so on and so forth. And this is all very useful in setting up this B. So in summary, a careful study of the causal structure of the deformed children enables the construction of a set of parents whose double deformations, both Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism, electric diffeomorphism, yield a satisfactory set B so that in the continuum limit, the left-hand side and the right-hand side are equal and non-trivial. Okay, now I could have shown you what the expression is, but before that, Notice that all this has been done in a non-covariant setting. And what I mean by this is, if you go back to the evaluation of the quantum shift, there were some coordinate dependent parts of the quantum shift eigenvalue. And if you just choose your coordinate patches, one for each vertex of the charge net arbitrarily, then you're going to run into problems with diffeomorphism covariance of this action. And one would like to have diffeomorphism covariance, by which I mean just the following. So if you just take the Hamiltonian constraint and you look at the action of diffeomorphisms on it, you have to get the Hamiltonian constraint with the diffeomorphic image of the lapse. So this is just a finite version of the Poisson bracket between the diffeo and the Hamiltonian constraint. And it turns out if you just choose these coordinate patches arbitrarily, this is no longer true, as you may expect. In order to make this true, one has to choose coordinate patches covariantly. And what I mean by that is that they must be chosen in such a way that if you have two diffeomorphically related charge nets and you're going to evaluate the action of the Hamiltonian constraint, the deformations which are generated of these two should also be diffeomorphic. Well, that is just the beginning of the game. One has to do more. And finally, there's a non-trivial proof, but one can actually prove diffeomorphism covariance. One uses some nice properties by Norbert Grott and Carlo in some early paper. So there's this Grott-Rovelli non-degeneracy of these vertices. Then one uses some other properties, etc. And then finally, it's a non-trivial proof. One can show this. OK. But once one has showed this, one has to go back to the commutator and check that with these slightly exotic choices of coordinates, because they have some bad properties in the limit, in the continuum limit, which I don't have time to get into. We have to check that the left-hand side and the right-hand side are still equal to each other. And when one does this, this is what roughly happens. So as I've mentioned before in the context of background-free quantizations, anything which is diffeo-covariant kind of obscures the relationship between sizes. So, you know, a small deformation here and it's like diffeomorphic image, which is huge, are basically the same thing. You can't tell the difference. So covariance acts as a magnifying glass, and the whole calculation becomes extremely sensitive to the exact choice of deformations you've made at finite triangulation. The earlier non-covariant setting, there was a lot of play. You could do various things. But here you are really nailing down the ambiguities, if you like, more and more by demanding more and more of your, of your calculation and of your theory. And so it turns out that in some very precise sense, you need the deformations to be conical. Okay, and I can discuss this, or maybe Casey will say more about it. Secondly, because of these diffeo covariance things, it turns out that, you see, when you have the first Hamiltonian constraint action, and then you have the second Hamiltonian constraint action. For the second Hamiltonian constraint action, you have to use a coordinate patch which is associated to the deformed vertex generated by the first constraint. Now, that deformed vertex is parameterized by delta. And so the coordinate system is parameterized by delta. And two deformations are, it turns out, for economy and also for other reasons, I think, two deformations at different values of delta are related by semi-analytic diffeomorphisms. So as delta becomes smaller, I have to also pull the coordinate patch with these semi-analytic diffeomorphisms. And remember, the whole thing is getting scrunched into one edge. And so as you go right to the vertex, the whole thing blows up, right, in the limit. And if it blows up, then again, the calculation blows up. So in order to actually make things work, you need to now also specify a benign enough, what I call short distance behavior of this function f in psi of f. Anyway, one can do that, and here's the final result for what I call a single vertex off-shell state. So I've just written it out, and Daniele, am I done with time, or how much? 5 minutes. Oh, great. I've gone much faster then. Okay, so maybe I can take a little time to actually tell you what these things are. So, oh, great. Okay. So here is the right hand, you know, here is what we want, right, classically. So this is really the troublesome thing, as you know, probably Jurek and Jorge, this is really the tough part to get, this MDN minus NDM. Then you have, because of the density weight, you have these structure functions with some factors of Q. And then you have this F dot E term over here, which is just like, you know, the diffeomorphism constraint piece. So correspondingly, you get this NDM minus the other way around, precisely because you take the first Hamiltonian constraint, that acts on the, the lapse is evaluated at the original vertex. Now you take the second Hamiltonian constraint, which moves the vertex here, and its lapse is going to be evaluated here, not here. And that's where one lapse is evaluated here, one lapse is evaluated here plus delta. And then you have a 1 over delta, and that gives you the derivative, right? So why you get that factor over there. Then these factors are kind of, you can kind of trace analogs to this object over here. So this factor of q to the something gives you these factors of inverse eigenvalues over here. These are edge tangents, which kind of come with these things here. The I sum come over some charge eigenvalues from these edges. And then this conical deformation business comes with this factor of theta over here. So that's the cone angle. And finally, this part over here can roughly be thought of to be this part with the derivative of F2 times G is like this F, which I talked about before. But then, as I said, there has to be some short distance behavior. And for that, one has to fix just any background metric. It doesn't matter which one you choose. And then you get certain terms because of that, and then this is the final answer. Okay, so let me now conclude and tell you what needs to be done. I mean, this is, to me, just the... Okay, fine. I thought I would be very tight for time, but since I have time, I can summarize. Okay, so to summarize, what I did was first, I told you why one should use higher density weight constraints, because using density weight 1 constraints always trivialize the right-hand side. And so you would not really be able to test whether you had an anomaly or not. So I used higher density weight constraints in this model with structure functions. And the key point, there are two key points. One was to use higher density weight constraints, and the second was to code the action in terms of phase space dependent diffeomorphisms. And this is something which is an important thing, and this will also, if one ever gets around to doing Euclidean gravity or the Lorentzian case, this is going to play an important role. So using these two structures, I wrote down the constraint action at finite triangulation, and then constructed a suitable space of off-shell states on which these constraints could act and on which a continuum limit could be taken. And all this was in, first the non-covariant case, but then once you put in diffeocovariance, you also had things like this cone angle and this distance structure coming in, and this is the fairly elaborate final result. So what has happened over here is that, as I said, I evaluated a certain set of complex numbers for the left-hand side and then also for the right-hand side and showed they were equal. Technically, what is happening is that these distributions, which are these off-shell states, they reside not in the kinematical Hilbert space, but in the algebraic dual. So this space of non-normalizable sums of charge network states. And what the constraints do, actually, are they take states in this subset of the algebraic dual and unfortunately map them out. Okay? So it's not really a linear representation space, and this is really the first step, to do this. So one has to work much harder, try to convert this into a linear representation space, a genuine habitat in the words of Marolf and Jurek. And that would put even more constraints on the kind of choices one makes. And it's one thing which is certainly, comes out directly is that because the function f was of the type Jurek and Dong used, it only depended on vertices. But now each time a Hamiltonian constraint acts, you have factors of a tangent vector coming in. And so this function f is going to have additional dependencies, like maybe on the tangent bundle or something like that. And a lot of work has to be done. I don't know how yet to do this, but it seems promising. One may be able to make progress. A small little technical remark for people who might hopefully have not lost completely is that this is really the continuum limit action of the commutator. It's not that I have the continuum limit action of the single Hamiltonian constraint, I have the continuum limit action of the commutator. I don't even have the continuum limit action of a product of Hamiltonian constraints. I think that can be done. One can actually write down with, so the more you insist, the more constraints you have on your kind of deformations. And I think you can do it. You can get at least a second Hamiltonian constraint to act properly. But then one would like n Hamiltonian constraints to act, and one would like to have a proper habitat, and this is a lot of work. I have, you know, this is just the beginning. Okay, so the next thing is, okay, let me just wind up quickly. Even though this all is looks nice and everything matches, is it physically correct? I don't know. So one needs Dirac observables. That's the most direct way of evaluating physics. And there is hope that one may actually be able to construct lots and lots of them. And Fernando Barbero and Eduardo Villaseñor are looking at this. Then one would like to go, of course, to the SU2 case of Euclidean gravity. So rather than do this, I'm more inclined to do this. Actually get SU2 to the level at which this thing is there. And here, there are some nice recent results by Alok Ladha, and so I'm also quite optimistic about how things may go here. And also Abhay has some interesting things to say over here. And finally, can all this, you know, it's very different from the way Thomas's constraint acts, and so I don't know enough about other ways of doing this covariantly, but it'll be great if some of these insights percolate to looking at more space-time covariant ways of tackling the dynamics. So, thanks.
So we have time for questions. Thanks for keeping to the a lot of time.
So thank you. It's very interesting. I had a question on the Grot-Rovelli moduli spaces. So long time ago, we were a bit mystified where the what the physical interpretation is of the moduli spaces in this paper by Grot and Rovelli. Does your result then suggest that there is perhaps a physical interpretation of these when you demand more of the theory in your words and ask for the closure of
yeah,
the
great.
Constrained
algebra?
Yeah, great.
So this is a nice question. Allows me to say something. So the thing is, you know, Carlo often thinks, you know, he wants to deform these spatial diffeomorphisms so that you get separability of the, you know, physical state space after you do diffeoaveraging. And here I'm using all over the place very, very strongly semi-analytic smooth structures. You know, otherwise nothing is going to work. But the point is that if you want to get the constraints to work, you need to consider electric field-dependent diffeomorphisms. In the quantum theory, the electric, like classical theory, you're fine, right? The electric field is just a smooth object. In the quantum theory, especially in U1, it's so nice, right? You can just exactly visualize these as lines of force. So these are very, very unsmooth objects, precisely at vertices. And so the things they do are kind of close to diffeomorphisms, which are smooth, but they're not smooth diffeomorphisms. And they end up altering the moduli, okay? So maybe there's a hope that, you know, you could actually, so it's not answering your question, but it's saying that maybe moduli somehow through some other way, which is not directly Carlo's way, maybe through looking at the dynamics, they go away and maybe you can get separability. But I mean, I don't know, who knows? So that's one comment I could make there.
Yes, Marwa, this is beautiful stuff. So I'll ask you my...
Where are you?
Here. There's a test that one would like a good Hamiltonian constraint operator to satisfy in order both to have a good low energy limit and also to be in accord with the spin foam dynamics, which Thomas's fails. And that's that you can generate the analogs of moves that involve switchings of more than one vertex, 2 to 3 moves, 3 to 2 moves, and so forth, rather than just expanding a vertex by adding other vertices. Do you have a hope with your operator value?
Actually, I don't know enough about. I could read up, but I don't know right now enough about the covariant ways to say something. What I can tell you is that in these toy models, and also for the diffeomorphism constraint, where probably you would like to make exactly similar arguments in parameterized field theory, for example. You do get physically correct results in the sense that if I do parameterized field theory using these ideas, then the final theory is actually scalar field theory on a null cone lattice. You know, the continuum theory, you quantize it using these kind of things with the Hamiltonian constraint, you get you get scalar field theory on a null cone lattice. And this is, of course, I mean, breaks Lorentz invariance, but it's not outrageous physically. I mean, so I think you do get the right ballpark physics out of such a thing. How they relate to these moves is exactly the last part of what I said, and someone can teach me a little bit more so that I can think about this and what the relations are. It would be enlightening for me as well. Yeah. You don't see that they do it? Is that? Well, this sees nearest neighbors in some sense, I would think. I mean, that's kind of where it's going, but of course it creates the neighbor. I mean, it's, I create new vertices. It's not on the same graph. I do create new vertices in this case. Yeah, I mean, I think that's where the derivative comes from, right? The MDN minus NDM. That comes because both these guys are involved, you know, the original one and the newly created one. And that's what you don't have in Thomas's calculation. So, it may not be. It may not be. And so, you know, I think the more constraints you have on this, the better, because, you know, that will sharpen things even more. So I think this is just the first step, and since almost nobody is looking at it, I mean, I need help, so help me.
Let's thank our speaker.